Welcome to NACSW's Podcast of the Month. Our podcast program makes available recordings of a wide variety of NACSW presentations and discussions on topics of particular interest to Christians in social work. Our Podcast of the Month program features a new podcast every 30 days for your listening pleasure. We hope you enjoy today's podcast.
All righty. Thank you all for being here. We appreciate that. Just a couple of slides. They let me do the objectives because I'm a nurse and that's sort of my thing. We have to have objectives and then be clear. And these are the ones that we're going to go over today. Basically, we're going to hear this adoption story from the perspective of four people that were involved with it. And we actually found sort of a fifth perspective that we hadn't really anticipated, which is that Caitlin is not only the natural sister of Beth, but she also is an adopted child herself because my husband adopted her after her birth father was no longer in the picture. So there's all kinds of neat stuff, and we keep finding new stuff all the time. We're going to talk about the common losses and healing in the reunion that are part of this particular narrative, and then we're going to apply the principle. Helen is going to do this piece. Alan Keith Lucas to the adoption narratives. And our agenda today, and does everybody have a handout? There are some handouts, I think, in the back. So the agenda is covered there. These are the things that we will go through, including the story of Moses as a framework from which we're going to tell these stories. The issues according to literature, Helen is going to present these things. Then we'll each tell our story, go back over some of the principles, and then the conclusions. So I think we are. Thanks very much. Well, appreciate you being here today. We're excited to tell this story, which we live excitedly every single day. There are lots of stereotypes and stigma around adoption, and I think I knew that personally from my narrative, and I knew it from some work in the past as a social worker in adoption. I took a look at the literature, and it's all over the literature. It might not surprise you at all. Some of the most typical, stereotypes, and we'll talk about that a little bit in our narratives, are the brokenness and the barrenness. I was sharing with one of the classes at Baylor last week. They're on the pregnancy section of the life cycle, and so Dr. Myers asked me to come in and talk about the non-pregnancy part of the adult life cycle. And so I read them from one of my journals years ago where I talked about what it was like to be barren and damaged and useless and unable to have a child but to want to be a parent. And in this journal entry, I actually wrote all these years ago about all the biblical narratives around barrenness, which you guys will be able to identify. But you just think about how many women, particularly in the Old Testament, were barren and how difficult that was for them. But I wrote in my journal entry at that time, all those biblical narratives turned out positive. God had an answer for every one of us. Sarah had a baby, right? And Rachel had a baby, and Hannah, who cried in the temple, so much so that the priest accused her of being drunk, and ended up having a baby, Samuel. And the end of my narrative in this journal says, there are no answers for me. So that sort of stigma around useless, barren, broken, damaged, shows up in the literature as well, the language of adopted children being unwanted. You weren't wanted, and so you were given up or given away. All those stigma and stereotypes around birth parents being dysfunctional or being unable to parent, and children being disposable. And the very language of adoption is very negative and stereotypical. You all may have some idea from your own experiences or your own reading about other stereotypes or stigma around adoption. Anybody? This is your opportunity to interact, my opportunity to interact with the audience. So if it asks you on the evaluation whether we did or not, be sure and say we have opportunity. Okay. We wanted to frame this in more scripture than Hannah, Rachel, Sarah, etc. were barren. There's this incredible story in the Old Testament about the adoption story of Moses. You all, I'm sure, are familiar with this story, but it's a fascinating difference, the story of adoption. Here we have Jochebed, the mother of Moses, who's living in Egypt at a time when Pharaoh has decided there are too many of these Israelite children, and he's particularly threatened by male babies who might eventually form an army and overthrow Pharaoh's throne. And so the edict was these male children were to be destroyed. So Jochebed finds herself pregnant and knows not only is this baby's life at risk, but if she keeps this baby, her other children's lives are compromised and at risk as well. She completes this pregnancy and has this baby that she knows this isn't safe, and she hides him for a short time, and then she makes the decision at some point. I think he's 3 months old maybe at that point. She makes the decision, I have to place this baby outside of the home. And she actually puts him in an ark, right? And places him in the Nile River. With an interesting caveat, because Moses had an older sister named Miriam, who already had some relationship with this baby, right? And it's Miriam that follows this little basket in the Nile River to see what happens to her little baby brother. It's Miriam who steps up when Pharaoh's daughter brings the basket out of the river and says, that you're going to need somebody to nurse this baby. Right? And it's Miriam, years later, who welcomes Moses back into the family and is actually a part of his ministry then. Well, there's another part of the story of Moses, and that's Pharaoh's daughter. So here's somebody who is a part of the Egyptian culture, very different life culture, religious experience than that of the birth mother who's placed this baby in the ark. I don't know this from scripture, but I speculate that she might have been barren, unable to have a child. I know from scripture that she heard the cries of the baby and responded to that little life. Pretty sure she had an idea about what was at stake, and she rescues this baby. I don't know if her motive was out of her concern about her own brokenness and her need to be a parent, or her motive was her concern for this tiny baby and the peril that he was in. I suspect it might have been some of both. Important part of the narrative, or at least for me, as an adopted mother. Pharaoh's daughter raises Moses in her home. I wonder if she knew that there would be a time when he would maybe return to his birth family. I wonder if she was really aware that Moses, to do what God had called him to do, needed the gifts and talents that were provided by his birth family, and needed the education and gifts and upbringing that he would have in his adopted family. Interesting part of the narrative, right? And of course, the main character in that narrative is Moses. So here's a baby who comes from one culture, one experience, one family experience, and now grows up in another family experience and has an interest and a desire to reconnect with his origins, with his family of origin, with his roots, with his family, and does that. And we see the power in his story of what he got from and was restored to in his birth family, and what he brought with him from his adoptive family, to be able to be God's chosen person to do the thing God called him to do. So we've sort of thought about that narrative, those four narratives in that one adoption story, and how powerful it is, how God was moving in each of those lives in each of those stories. And that there's brokenness and pain and difficulty and challenge in each four of those stories. And none of those stories are easy stories. None of those stories are without some danger, some peril, and some willingness to be vulnerable. Well, this is a scholarly presentation, so you can't get away from it without all the scholarly stuff, right? That sounds very scholarly, doesn't it? Scholarly stuff, right? So here's the stuff. Here's the stuff. The paper will be submitted and published, I expect, in the next, submitted very soon. So you'll have access to the whole lit review. If you want and need it before then, I'll ask the journal. We can give it to you before then, but certainly it will be available. The whole lit review will be available to you. I didn't realize how rare adoption is statistically. Only 2 people in the United States per 100,000 were adopted. And I looked around the School of Social Work recently, our conference table where our faculty and staff were gathered, and thought, there's a reason why I don't understand adoption to be statistically rare, and that's because there are a lot of adoptive parents and families with adoption experience around the table in School of Social Work. And I wonder if that's not true of social work gatherings everywhere, where we might be that statistical outlier, a place where our adoption rates are not rare. Less than 2% of unplanned pregnancies result from adoption. Does that surprise you? Yeah, it surprises me as well. And I didn't put this on the slide, but because it's not from the Congressional Coalition on Adoption. I'm going to put a second citation, so I probably shouldn't even say it. But one of the articles I read said that in our culture, it's more socially acceptable to have an abortion than to place a child for adoption. Most socially acceptable with unplanned pregnancies is to have a child and raise the child, whether you're prepared to be a parent at that point or not. But abortion is much more socially acceptable than our culture of adoption. That's something we ought to think about as social workers and congregations. What do we do to begin to change these negative stereotypes around adoption and to understand the powerful, positive, wonderful experience that it is. We do know from the literature that there, and these are almost all older children, difficult to adopt children, but there are almost a 500,000 children who are available for adoption and not placed. And that's another thing we probably should be thinking about as social workers and people in churches and congregations and part of ministries. They're going to take care of this. These are ministers, right? Did you have a question? Yes, ma'am.
With the last statistic, so here with the 2%, we're talking about unplanned pregnancies, but the last statistic has to do with children who are primarily going through Department of Social Services. Mm-hmm.
Parental rights have been terminated. Frequently, it's Child Welfare Services, CPS. But also there are a number of children's homes, residential child care facilities where children are growing up, where their parental rights have been terminated or relinquished. They're available for adoption for a host of reasons, may not be. And disability is a frequent reason.
So we know that those people who are seeking adoption
are looking for healthy infants.
Yeah.
And I'll say, are more frequently looking for healthy white infants. Right? And there's a fair amount of international adoption that has to do with that interest in infants as well. We have a visiting professor from South Korea with us this year, is actually looking at the impact of international adoption on Korean babies and children who come to the United States, grow up in homes, and what the cultural adaptation is, the difficulties in going back into their own home, country, culture, trying to achieve some kind of reconnection with their roots and origins, and having difficulty doing that. So she's really doing research in the area, trying to enhance domestic adoption in Korea. Well, the literature points out, and this is pervasive across the literature, a number of issues in adoption. One has to do with the kind of history of secrecy and shame around adoption. And particularly as recently as 10 years ago and then more distant, the sort of notion that if people were adopted, you really didn't talk about it. And it wasn't unusual for adopted children to not even be told that they were adopted, like there's something wrong with it. And I think any time you have secrecy and shame, you get stigma right along. That's maybe the third S that comes with it. And you'll hear the stigma and pain in the narratives that you hear today. Our experience is consistent with the literature as well, that in all the narratives of the adoption story, there's loss and grief. And you'll hear those themes repeated in the narratives as we share them with you. And there's a wish, and it's across the literature, a wish for reunion, a wish for connection to family of origin, biological roots. One of the things that Alan Keith Lucas talked about so much in his writings was the need that children have to know and be connected to their families of origin. In fact, he said real strongly, and I may be co-opting something, I don't know, but he said real strongly that it's almost impossible for a child to love themselves and have good self-concept if they can't find something to love in their family of origin. And so if your story is shrouded in secrecy and shame, there can be a profound impact on the self-esteem of children as well. If something's a secret that then gets outed at a family reunion when one cousin's talking to the other cousin and says, you know, no, I heard my mom talking to so-and-so, you know, you're adopted. I mean, right? If it has to be a secret that somebody outs, right, can it mean anything good about me? It's an issue. And if I wish for reunion, you know, what does that mean for my adopted family? So if I'm adopted and I want to know my birth family, do I have to worry that it's going to hurt their feelings or they're going to feel the same way about me or, right? So that's all over the literature. And adoptive parents with a desire for their adoptive children to be healthy and whole, but a wish not to lose them, and a concern, you know, that nothing interrupt the bond and the attachment and the relationship. And we'll talk about that as well in the narratives. And I think the one thing that shows up occasionally in the literature is that there is the possibility with reunion of the development of new family. And I just introduced to you the idea that reunion, our discovery, is that reunion can actually also mean union, where two families are one family. So, the most important thing to hear is the narratives, and Jennifer is going to share her narrative with you first, and then four of us will, and we'll go from there.
I was going to try and speak directly, but I don't know if I'll be able to, so I had to bring my notes. So I'll just start. I've told this story before. Usually it's a very abbreviated version. This is the longer version because I think there are a lot of important things to share with you. My story is not that unusual today. I was a teenage mother. My firstborn, Katie, was not yet a year old when I felt those familiar symptoms. Overwhelming nausea, that deep sense of protectiveness. I knew I was pregnant. My reaction, though, was not the same as it had been when I found out I was pregnant with Katie. When I was pregnant with Katie, I was scared, but I was also excited. It was something new and different, and I felt overwhelmingly that I would do anything to protect her. When I found out I was pregnant with, I named her Megan, so Beth, I was terrified, but I was also ashamed, and I was guilt-ridden, and I was overcome with the desire to separate myself from this new life. I could not take care of two babies, and I knew that. My first thought was abortion. That was the very first thing that I thought. Even though I was a teenage mother, I had been out of high school. I had a good job. I was actually working two jobs, and I was going to nursing school. And I thought, okay, I have some money, and I can afford to do this. I was not deterred by the medical mechanics of the whole process. And whatever fugue state it was that I was in, when whatever passed for the relationship that I had with her biological father was gone, I knew I did not have any way to count on him for any kind of support, nor did I want any connection to him whatsoever. What I did not count on was the toll that this decision would have on the rest of my family, especially my mother and stepfather. My stepfather, in fact, looked me in the eye and said, I will not live in a house with a murderer. And I came to understand that if I moved forward with that decision to have an abortion, that he would leave my mother. And I loved him a lot, and he loved my mother a lot. My mother loved him, and I did not in any way want to be responsible for breaking up that marriage. I couldn't do it. I couldn't think of anything else to do. All I could do was watch my body change and try and get up out of bed every day. And I knew that I had no refuge in time. The passage of time was not going to help me. I was angry. I was really angry. I was angry with myself for having placed myself in this situation. I was angry with my parents for not supporting me in whatever decision I wanted to make. I was angry at that little life that was depending on me. It was, you know, I was 19. I didn't have a whole lot of that separation still. I didn't have a path forward. I just couldn't do anything except get out of bed every day. One morning over apple juice, though, and this is all I could drink at the time that I was pregnant, at the kitchen table, my mother said, why don't you think about adoption? And I'll never know what it cost my mother to make that suggestion. My mother had her own issues with having been separated from her children and with parenthood, and I can't imagine what it did to her to suggest that I should give my baby to strangers to raise. But it was a respite. It was a shining light for me. And so I did something that I had not done in many years, and I went into my bedroom alone and I prayed. And it was the deepest sense of peace that I ever had in my life. And so I decided that I would look at this word adoption, and I would touch it and taste it and see what would happen. And the world didn't stop spinning, and I didn't fall over. I suddenly had a path forward. And so I knew that I was not prepared to care for this little child, but God knew that there was a way for me to be sure that she was cared for. And so I started looking for a resource. I was going to find the best parents that I could. I was no longer angry. I was no longer ashamed. I wasn't even afraid anymore. I had a new purpose, and it was a mother's purpose. It was the purpose for every mother to find care for their child. And I will never forget when I came upon the file for Don and Helen Harris. Diane, who was the adoption social worker that I found, she told me about their disappointments. They had two other adoptions for little girls planned, and they had fallen through right at the last minute, and they were heartbroken, and they decided that they would withdraw from adopting. They couldn't go through that again. And then Diane told me about their little son, Daniel, who all he wanted for Christmas was a baby sister. And that's what I did. I laughed. I thought, oh, perfect. I knew they were right. I saw only that Helen was a social worker and that Don was a high school principal, and I knew they lived somewhere in Central Texas. And I thought, this is a wonderful family. Diane knew that they were perfect, and she was great. She was wrong. As the days passed and my time to deliver drew near, I thought very often about this woman who would raise my baby. And I thought more about her, honestly, than I did about that little baby. I did normal pregnant girl things. I walked around with my hand on my belly, and I nested like all good pregnant women do. But I wondered if Helen was doing those things as well, was she preparing? Was she terrified to prepare? She'd been there before, and I knew that there was nothing that I would not do to ensure that my little baby went to this woman. When Megan was born, I longed to nurse her and to keep her with me and to kiss her little face. But I also had to set up some kind of emotional boundary. I couldn't keep her with me. So I sent her down to the nursery in the hospital. You know, they don't keep you very long anymore, about 24 hours. But I sent her down there, and the nursery nurses, being good nursery nurses, they wanted to bring her back so that I could feed her. And I kept having to say, please feed her for me, because I'm giving her up for adoption. And those are terrible words. They're terrible words. I didn't give up. But I didn't know that there were other words to say. Relinquishing Beth to the foster mother while we dealt with all of the legal issues was probably one of the most difficult things that I've ever had to do. But at the end of that process, that sense of peace returned to me. And I knew that I was doing absolutely the right thing. And it's the only thing that made it possible for me to not curl up and die of grief right there on the courthouse steps. Over the years, that grief lessened. I described it in my narrative here as a hard knot, like a bruise in my heart, and that's what it was. I lived with it there, and I didn't mess with it except on Mother's Day, which was always the hardest day of the year for me. And every year on Mother's Day, I would take that pain out, and I would just let it do whatever needed to do. And at the same time, my family, while they gave me space to grieve, there was also sort of this sense of perhaps you should be over that by now. Maybe this has gone on long enough. And I think I might have felt a little bit of that myself, that this has gone on long enough. You should probably stop pestering that, stop picking at it like a scab. I was wrong, of course. You don't get over that. It never stops hurting. But talking about it openly made me stronger in that broken place. And it made it possible for me to tell this story. I've never told it to this many people at one time, so clearly I'm moved. But then came the day that I never, ever dared to hope for. Diane, the social worker, found me. And she found me on Facebook, of all places. And she found Katie. She remembered Katie's name. My name had changed. Katie's hadn't. And she found Katie on Facebook, and she sent me a message and said, are you the Jennifer who gave a baby for adoption in 1993? Two. Wow, I'm old. All right. Beth wanted to connect with me, and Diane was helping her with that. And nearly an adult, her search for self at that time wouldn't be complete unless she had found a way to reconnect with her roots, which I totally understood. Now, I had to be vetted by Helen first, and I got that. Not only did I get that, I was really grateful for it. Well, that's great. But I couldn't wait to talk to Helen. I think I was worrying with myself about who I was more excited to talk to first, Helen or Beth. I wanted to tell her how grateful I was for her having taken my child and loved her, for having the capacity to love another woman's baby. So after Helen and I talked, and she decided I wasn't weird, and that I would not be in any way harmful to Beth, which again is a giant blessing, and we arranged a time for Beth and I to talk on the phone, and I was so nervous that I couldn't sit still. And when I got to talk to her, angel song could not have been more beautiful than hearing the sound of her voice on the phone for the first time. And then I got to go meet them. And what an incredible experience that was, to be able to hold her in my arms again after 18 years, and to be able to hug her mother, because she's a mother. I brought Katie, actually, to Raleigh-Durham a few years ago to meet Beth and Helen. That was fantastic. And then a year after that, about 6 months later, we all met up in Dallas with my sister and my mother, and our family continued to grow. And what I want to share is that being a birth mother has profoundly changed my life. I understand how powerful spirit is, and the strength that grief can impart, and that it's okay to grieve, and that there is a love that mothers have, and it doesn't matter whose child it is. Mothers love all children. Mother love, no matter what adjective you use to describe that mother, is a force beyond the ability of words to describe. And once I came to understand that my decision to choose another mother for Beth made it possible for me to be a better mother for Katie. Thank you so much. We should have brought tissues and handed them out. In choosing that, I was empowered to be worthy of that title, mother, knowing that I could do everything I needed to do to make a good life for Katie, secure that Beth had a mother to do the same for her. Now I'm going to turn the floor over to Katie.
Hi. She really is. She's a good mom.
Aww.
She did everything she could. And then some. I remember when I was just about 5 or 6 years old, I remember looking at these two pictures we had of Megan, Beth, and thinking how similar they look. The same deep brown eyes, with curly hair, and the same little nose. But that was all that I had of her, was that picture and those similarities. And all I could think about was looking at those pictures and thinking, I wonder if she's thinking about us. Thinking about me as her sister. My mom, she's thinking about the same things. So, I don't really remember when I made the actual connection that this is my sister. I don't have anybody else as a sibling, but she was mine. No matter where she was, she was my sister. And although I grew up with other siblings and many children, they had a connection that I never got to understand. There was a longing for that kind of sibling rivalry or a rough playing that I never got the same. When my mom sat me down and said that Diana made contact with her, we were looking, I was kind of shocked, and I'd never thought that this was going to happen. And I was just thought, well, she's living her life how she wants to live. And this is, we just move forward from it. And I started telling everyone about Beth as I had finally found her on Facebook. And so I was able to show them pictures of how grown she was and how proud I was to be her sister. And about Dawn and Helen, who gave her the support and love that she needed. That no matter what, I know Mom made the correct decision in her family, but these people were right. And so, having this kind of story to tell people is always really hard. People don't really understand it. They don't really get how you're the first child, they get your mom had another one, and she could just give one up for adoption. They don't get that. So I explained to them the story that she basically just told you, and their faces kind of change. They kind of get softer and more understanding. They realize that she did it to better a child and another family. And everything kind of changes in their perspective, and they just kind of get whole. They don't really understand how I'm just okay with it all, how how are you calm, you know. Grew up to be one person. We all grew up to be great people. We grew from it. Meeting Beth last year was an experience I'll probably never forget. We were at breakfast one morning. We made our coffee exactly the same. We've never met each other before. Everything in the same pattern. I remember looking over at Helen and she's just kind of dumbfounded, just in shock. But we both looked at each other like, what? And she says, you made your coffee
the exact same way. We took a drink at the exact same time. She said, yeah, must be related.
She still says it almost every time.
Must be related. So, overall, this has been beyond the greatest experience. To share it with people was even more amazing. To share it with family, no matter who they are, is beyond great. These people are who I have to live with forever, and anybody else. All right. Meeting Beth was beyond fantastic. Growing up with her, there was no doubt in my mind that our lives were going to be different in some way. She's a polar person than I could have ever imagined. She's great. But I believe that we are all brought together because of one reason, and that was because we have a unique story. And our story needs to be shared for those who can't understand it. They need to understand it, that this is something that happens and it can be great. So meeting all of them was great. And now here's the step.
I don't ever remember not knowing that I was adopted. It's always been a part of my story. It was, in fact, my bedtime story as I was growing up. You know, once upon a time, there was a young mommy who loved you very much, etc. But even so, I always felt something was missing. There was this piece of my soul, this that I couldn't really articulate its name or describe its shape, but its absence was real and it was tangible. And, you know, it's hard to say how I can grieve for someone I've never met. All I had of her was two handwritten letters, two photographs, and a blanket that she made for me. And that's all I had of her to, you know, to say that she was this real person somewhere. But, you know, that grief for someone you've never met is a real thing. I remember when I was about 7 years old, and I ran up to my mom. I was just almost inconsolable. I was crying, and the only words I had to describe my feelings at that time were, I miss Jennifer. Mm-hmm. I miss this person that I had never met before. And so it's hard to describe, but it is a real thing. There was a piece of my soul that was missing. And I felt it growing up, listening to my peers. You know, they had all of these things like their moms would tell them, oh, when I was pregnant with you, I did all of these things. Or when you were born, all these things happened on the day that you were born. I didn't have any of those stories. I couldn't share in those things. I couldn't relate to my peers in that way. And so I felt left out. I felt awkward. You know, I just kind of stayed silent during those times. And, you know, I mean, everybody knew I was adopted. It wasn't something I was ashamed of. It wasn't something I was unwilling to share. In fact, it was something that I was, you know, kind of proud of. Like, I was special because of it. So, I mean, I never had any problem telling people that I was adopted, telling my friends that I was adopted. But I didn't have answers to those kinds of questions that they got to ask their parents. I didn't, and so I kind of stayed silent during those conversations. And you know, sometimes they would kind of like forget and say, well, you know, why aren't you saying anything? Well, I was adopted. And then it'd just be awkward because, you know, what if 13-year-old kids say to that? I don't know. But, you know, there's a social stigma around the adopted child as well. I remember one time in late elementary, early junior high, I had an unkind classmate who, it was kind of like the same conversation that I was just talking about, and they said something how, you know, I must have been unwanted or I must have been unloved, You know, and I never really took any of those things to heart because I grew up with such a positive experience and such a positive view of my adoption story and of Jennifer. And so I never internalized that, but it was always very apparent that they had something that I didn't. And so that was always very, very real growing up. My mom and dad always did their very best to portray my adoption and Jennifer as very, very positive. They always spoke of Jennifer in these glowing terms and how much she loved me and how much she wanted to take care of me and make sure that I was taken care of and all of these things. My mom still does to this day, expresses her grief that I couldn't grow up with Jennifer. And at the same time, how that's at war with her joy that I got to grow up with her. And I'm really glad that she was able to express those things to me, because those are things that, you know, I often kind of felt a little bit but didn't really want to say. Because, of course, I imagined what my life might have been like if I'd been able to grow up with Jennifer. Of course I did. But, you know, then I realized that God has written all of our stories this way for a reason. And my past experiences make up who I am. And if I had grown up with Jennifer, I would be a different person than I am today, because I wouldn't have had the experiences that I've had growing up with my parents. So our stories have been written this way for a reason. And I wouldn't change a thing. I wouldn't change a single thing, because if I hadn't had those experiences, I'd be a different person. And so I wouldn't change a thing about it. So when I was probably 14 or 15 in that, you know, stage of identity formation where, you know, I'm supposed to figure out who I am, who I'm supposed to be, who I'm called to be.
Who I look like,
yeah, that too. You know, the overwhelming feeling that I had was just stuck. Because I felt like, how am I supposed to know who I am if I don't know where I came from? How am I supposed to know where I'm going if I don't know my roots? And so we made the decision to search. I was a senior in high school, and in February, a few months before I graduated high school, we found Katie on Facebook, and then we found Jennifer, and that led to a phone call. I remember that phone call. Pretty much the same way that Jennifer does. I remember I made the call and she said hello, and the only thing I said was, "It's me." And then it was silent for about 3 minutes because neither of us could say anything because we were both just crying. And then we just talked, you know, and I was finally talking to this person. I mean, she was a real person now. And that phone call led to, eventually that September, a face-to-face meeting. So, picture this for a second. I've been a college freshman for about a week. It is Labor Day weekend of my freshman year at Baylor. So all of these transitions that I've just gone through over the summer, and now I'm going to meet my birth mother. I'm going to meet Jennifer. This person I've dreamed about my entire life, this moment that I've dreamed about my entire life. And now suddenly I'm wondering, oh my gosh, what if it's not everything I dreamed about? What if it's not everything I made it up to be? And then what if it is?
No pressure.
Right. So I was super nervous, and I kept going back and forth from being super nervous to being so excited I was jumping out of my skin. And then we walked into the hotel lobby and I saw her. And I knew it was her. And then we hugged and then I was whole again. I was healed. And now I had all of those answers that I had been searching for my entire life. You know, and we got to talk about those things. Like, you know, I heard all of those phrases from Jennifer that I've been hearing from my friends for our whole lives. And when I was pregnant with you, and you know, on the day you were born. And I can tell people these things now because I had these answers. You know, and I was able to start to identify those things about me that are, you know, that are genetic, and those things about me that are how I grew up, and those things about me that are just me. And I, you know, not many people have, you know, get to have the opportunity to identify between nature and nurture and in between. And so,
that's strong. There's an article there.
So, I mean, you know, it was cool. I mean, you know, we have a picture where she and I are making the exact same face. A face I've made my whole life, but, you know, nobody else did. And now I know where it comes from. But it was just really, really special moments, and a lot of them all weekend. Everyone just kind of cried the entire weekend. And then that November, I met Katie. And I mean, she just instantly just jumped into the big sister role. You know, we gave each other a hug, and I started to cry, and she was like, "Are you okay? Is everything okay?" And then I wrote this down. We make our coffee in the exact same way. But guys, it was like, it was simultaneous. Like, we weren't watching each other. We just kind of did it. It was eerie, almost. Like, it was really weird. But
that could be an egg profile.
So I experienced this identity crisis growing up, and now I know my roots. I know where I come from. I feel so much support for my future. I know where I'm supposed to go from here. I know what I'm called to be. And I know who I want to be. And I know that I have so much support behind me. And just my family is growing, and my heart is growing with it. And that's something, like, also not a lot of people got growing up, is like, or even after I met Jennifer, you know, how can, you know, does, if you meet Jennifer and if you love Jennifer, does your love for your mom diminish because of that? No, of course it doesn't. You know, both of my moms have multiple children, and the addition of one more child doesn't make them love their children any less. So how can I not love both of my moms? How can my heart not grow with the addition of more family?
Wow, right? Well, you know, there's a lot of scripture that suggests that God can bring good from bad, right? And I will tell you that it never occurred to me that I wouldn't have a choice about whether I'd be a parent or not. I mean, I figured when I was ready to be a parent, I'd be a parent, right? When I was ready to get married, I'd get married. When I was ready to have a baby, I'd have a baby. But life intervened, and I had a desperate, difficult illness, and a couple of years of really nasty, awful medicine, and then a big surgery, and the result of all that was the doctor said, I think you're going to be all right, but you're not going to have children. What? What? You don't get to decide that. He said, well, it's done. It was the only way. It's done. Now, I was working at a children's home with children whose parents weren't able to take care of them. And I actually was doing the adoption part of that children's home. So I was doing home studies for people who wanted to adopt. I was doing a foster care program. I was working with birth mothers, some of whom were trying to make the decision about, am I going to be able to parent this child or not? So I had some children in foster care. I was working with the birth mothers. Sometimes those birth mothers were able to benefit enough from the services, get their lives together, make changes, decide they could do it, whatever was happening with them. Sometimes it worked out where these children were able to return home and grow up with their families of origin, which was way cool. And sometimes it didn't. Sometimes the best decision for the birth mom, for the child, for everyone, was to relinquish, to say, I can't provide for this child what this child needs, but I want this child to have everything he needs, everything she needs. So will you help me find a family who can do that? And I did that a number of times. And I can tell you that every time Penn went to the paper to sign the relinquishment, inside, I hurt. I knew it was right, I knew it was best, I knew it was a good decision. It wasn't that I questioned the decision, but I grieved the notion that this child and this parent would not be able to live together and know each other. And I think that's part of why social workers can do this work, right? Is because we really do value the relationship. Families separate and help create new families. We know that something's lost in that, and we grieve that. Well, then I had this terrible, awful stuff and surgery and this pronouncement. Continued doing the work, but my heart wasn't in the work. In fact, I was working with one particular mom who didn't show up for visits and didn't follow through, and I was just getting so angry with her. I didn't give any thought to what the barriers were institutionally, maybe, that we set up for those visits, or how hard it was for her to come into a foster home where the folks actually wanted to be adopted parents. I didn't think about any of those dynamics that I normally would have been really tuned into. I was just ticked off. And at one point she said, you know, this isn't going to work. I'm going to relinquish and be complacent. She made the arrangements. We're in the room. She puts pen to paper and signed her name. And for the first time, I didn't feel pain. I felt triumph. Ha!
Got it. We'll get him into the home.
She said that. And boy, the conviction of the Holy Spirit was all over me. I had not given her a real chance. I had not believed in her. Do you know what I mean? That's not ethical social work practice, and it's certainly not the expression of Christian faith. So I went to my supervisor, and I said, I need to tell you what's going on with me. I can't do this work. And she said, now we'll get some counseling, you know, get a little help for yourself. You're right, you're kind of broken. And I said, no, until I've done my own work, I can't do this work. And I resigned. And it's actually through that whole process that God led me to work in hospice. Nothing very much different from adoptions and hospice. Although I got to tell you, there are a lot of similar stories of new life and new birth and new and grief and importance of grief. I did do my own work. I did see someone. I did my work, and that was the work of healing my own broken heart and accepting that God's choices in my life were going to be different. And I sort of thought, you know, I just won't be a parent. And then I met this gorgeous blue-eyed guy over here that's filming. And he was so cute. And we played tennis, and he beat me in tennis. And I got to tell you, that's significant, because I used to fancy myself a pretty decent tennis player. And I played a lot of tennis with a lot of guys, and I beat them all. And you don't want to marry somebody you can beat. I mean, this was a while ago. You know? But women, you know, back then, it's not a good plan to marry a guy you can beat in tennis. Well, he beat me. And I thought, you know, this could work. And that scared the fool out of me, right? Because he also had been talking... I had really well connected with his family, and nieces and nephews that he loved and cared about, and I was pretty sure he was going to want to have babies. And I was also pretty sure I didn't want to get any more involved with somebody who wanted to have babies, because that couldn't be with me. So I said, this has been a lot of fun, and we can play tennis sometime if you want to, but the dating part is over. Well, why? Well, because I really like you. It's not the only time he's thought I was crazy. So I explained to him, I am damaged goods. I can't have children. And I know you want to. So I think it's just better if we just, you know, be friends. And he said, so I thought you were like a social worker and used to do like adoption work. Is that, did I miss that part of the story? And I said, yeah, well, yeah. He said, you don't believe in adoption? Well, obviously we got married. But we began to talk and pray about adoption. We adopted this little boy named Daniel. And we were doing all right. And a couple years later, Daniel started to want a sister, specifically a sister. And Daniel's birth mother was pregnant again. Asked the social worker to call us. She wanted Daniel's sibling to be raised with him. So we started getting nursery ready, and she miscarried. Mm-hmm. And I will tell you that it is possible to have an emotional miscarriage. Mm-hmm. Her body miscarried. I agree. Right along with her. But who do you tell that to? I'm really sad and crying all the time because I've had an emotional miscarriage. I mean, physical miscarriages don't even get the attention they need to get, the support, the help, the care, right? And then there was another mom who chose us, our profile, and brought the baby to term and then said, I need to parent this child. Now, I'm going to tell you something, and I grieved that, but I celebrated it. Because no mom should have to be separated from her child because of finances or pressure from anybody, family, whoever, right? There are real reasons to place, but I don't think those are them. So if she could work it out to keep that baby, that was a good thing. And my heart was broken, right? And I did what I do. I said, that's enough. I'm not doing this anymore. And I told the social worker, this has been really fun, but Dan's great, we're doing fine. And we're not going to do this anymore. And then the social worker called and said, well, I know you said that, but I checked your profile, and Jennifer chose you, and will you just think about it? And I said, no, I said no. And Don said, there are two of us here. By the way, actually three with Daniel. You're outvoted. So we decided we would meet her. She was in foster care. There were some legal issues to be worked out with Jennifer. And so Daniel and I decided, I didn't want Daniel to know, right? So we flew. I said, if you've been wanting to fly on an airplane, right? It was five. Like, yeah. I said, we're going to fly to Corpus. Daddy's going to drive down. Why is Daddy going to drive down? I said, so we don't have to fly back. But we're just going so you can fly. That's the only reason we're going, just so you can fly. Lie, lie, lie. So we go to Corpus, and Daddy picks us up at the airport. And I said, Diane, your social worker, because we had stayed in touch through the years, your social worker said, there's a family she needs to run by and see. We're just going to run by and see this family. They got a big dog named Sammy. Some other kids there. I think there's a baby there, too. Okay. So we get there, and you know, you want to hold the baby? I said, not really. Don holds the baby. She falls asleep on his shoulder. Man, this is tough stuff. Okay, I'll hold the baby. So I'm holding the baby. This is our future. Daniel said, can I hold the baby?
That's it.
He said, you're fine, honey.
It's over.
I said, sit. All right, it's done, right? So I said, sit up here, prop some pillows around, be careful with her head. And so he reaches out and he says, come to Big Brother. Right? I don't know why, but I know that God gave us the gift of this baby in our lives. I remember thinking, I'm so sad that she can't grow up with this incredible plan in this remote. And then I knew I was healed, because I wasn't only happy for us, I was also sad for them. And we have created this, not created, we just told this story through the years to her as an infant and on. And every year on her birthday, I wrote a letter to Jennifer and tried to chronicle what had happened in the previous year. And some of them are funny, I think. Yeah. You know, because Beth had a temper. As an 18-month-old, I'm just saying. In fact, she got chicken pox at 6 months old, and she's the pediatrician said Daniel had them, so he brought them home to his sister, right? And the pediatrician said, she's 6 months old, she probably still has immunity from her birth mother, and she probably won't get them. And I said, well, what if she does? And he said, well, we need to get her some Zovirax. Antivirals, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And we'll get the right Z, right? Zovirax, and he said, just call me, I'll order it. And I said, cool. Well, she breaks out with her first little pustule on Friday night at 8 o'clock. And there's a different doctor on call, right? So we didn't get any Zovirax because he doesn't believe in it. I complained to our physician the next week, and he said, he doesn't have any kids. When he does, he'll believe it. Right, it's true, right? It's true. So this kid stands in the playpen for 6 days and nights. I mean, she did not like chicken pox. It was not fun. And now she sort of had a little temper. And sometimes she would bang her head on the floor. She's also very smart. So she'd like get up, she'd be on the carpet, she'd get mad, she'd get on all fours and whack that head down. Oh, little temper fit. And roll over her back.
Katie did the same thing.
There we go. Right? Katie did the same thing. But we had a little kitchen dining area, so there's this little weather strip. So the carpet, you know, goes that way, and then there's linoleum. And one day she didn't realize where she was, so she gets to the edge of the carpet, and she whacks that head down on the linoleum. So a couple days later, she's ticked off. She gets down and realizes she's on the linoleum, and she does a little. Okay, this is a smart kid, right? Which I'm pretty sure she gets from
you. Yeah, temper probably.
She still bangs her head on the carpet.
Still bangs her head on the carpet. Yeah. So one of the things I tried to do was write Jennifer, really, you know, she's got a temper, she had the chicken pox, this is the year she played t-ball, she got hit in the face with the ball 5 times, she doesn't want to play anymore, t-ball's not going to be her thing, she wants to take piano lessons, she's taking piano lessons, she made a profession of faith, she loves Jesus, so that Jennifer would have a picture. That's growing. When Beth wanted to, we got the crocheted baby blanket and the pictures out of the fireproof safe, because I didn't want anything to happen to them because they were irreplaceable. And she could hold them and cuddle them and look at them as long as she wanted. It was a point at which, I don't remember how old you were, she said, have you done that letter yet that you do on my birthday every yet? Yeah. I said, I've just about finished. And she said, can I write one too? And we sent the letters to the agency so that anytime Jennifer was ready for them, they would be ready for her. She would have a picture of Beth's chronology. Knowing that parent does not have to be physically present to be important in the life of the child. And not just in the life of that child. This is the one who gave this child life. This person who's so important to us. I love her. I respect her. I admire her. Grateful to her. Have always been grateful to her. Now that I know her, I'm even more grateful. So the decision for Beth to search was not a surprise. Our son Daniel decided not to search. I think he may someday. He asked the question, has my birth mother ever picked up those letters? When she does, I want to meet her. He wants her to initiate. And I think that may well happen someday. And we'll welcome him when it does. And if he changes his mind and wants to search, I figure Facebook can do it for us again, right? Best decision to search, I think the timing of it might have been partly thinking about Katie being grown. Yeah. And not disrupting the family that Jennifer created, whatever the family that was. I can tell you this. Jennifer did have to be vetted by me, but it, in case you're wondering, that wasn't a vetting of will she get to talk to Beth or not. She was going to be talking to Beth. It was Helen's insatiable need to control so that if there were going to be bumpy areas and problems, I could start to figure out how to help Beth with things, which I think is just part of that mother love. Mm-hmm. Watching them hug in that hotel lobby was the best moment of my life. Because this child who I love was really whole. Now, people have asked me, aren't you threatened about that? And I don't understand that because I can't imagine being threatened by something that helps my child be whole. Mm-hmm. Now, what if Jennifer was an amazing, wonderful, incredible? Here's what I know. All people are both amazing and wonderful and incredible and have flaws, starting here. And whatever Beth's reality is, and whatever Jennifer's reality is, whatever my reality and Katie's reality is. So here we are together, figuring out the bumps and bruises and love and hugs and good and bad. That's our reality. And whatever our reality would have been important to connect with. And would have helped Beth be whole. And maybe Jennifer, too. Right? The thing I didn't anticipate was that, I mean, I really thought Beth will have a reunion and she'll be connected. And she asked questions like, so Mom, you know, like if they invite me for Christmas sometime or something like that, like, you know, if I'm not with you for Christmas, will that be okay? I mean, how will you feel about that? And I said, wait, do you mean like you won't see us at all over Christmas? Or do you mean on Christmas Day or for a week or two you'll be somewhere else but there'll be a time when we'll have Christmas together? She said, no, well, we'll have Christmas together because I can get my stuff. She didn't really say that. I made that up. And I said, honey, you know, the day's coming when you're going to get married and your husband's going to have a family and you're not always going to be home for Christmas. And sometimes we'll have Christmas in January or in November. And there may be times when you're with your birth mother, with Jennifer and her family, for Christmas or Easter or spring break or whatever holiday. And I'm going to be totally okay with that. Here's what I didn't expect. I didn't expect that this reunion of that would result in union of two families who really care about each other and enjoy each other a lot. And I think that will continue to grow. Keith Lucas knew this stuff a long time ago. You know, the guy's been dead 15 years. And he knew this stuff 30 years before he died. And why people haven't listened to him more through the years, I don't know. But he said out loud, our Christian faith and social work practice is all about redemption and reconciliation. It's all about reunion. It's all about recognizing the strengths in each other instead of focusing on the flaws in each other. Because we all have flaws. None of us is perfect. All of us are in need of a perfect God. Right? He said years ago, birth families have central significance in the health and welfare of children. Now, I have some colleagues in the room. Can I out you? Dr. Pooler has two daughters who were adopted from China. He knows how important their biological roots are to them, but it hasn't been possible to find their birth parents. But he took his girls back to China to help them connect with their culture and their language and the places they came from and the people who knew them when they were tiny before they came to the States. And if God provides the opportunity, if there's an opportunity to do more than that, he will. Because he knows that birth families, roots, who we are, has central significance to us. Keith Lucas said a long time ago, a parent who relinquishes for permanency, that's different language than gives up or gives away. A parent, he used social work language, relinquishes for permanency, but he also said, a parent who lovingly places a child, makes arrangements for a child to have everything they need, has made a loving decision intended to benefit. But that is not abandoning the child. We have to do something about the stigma so that birth mothers, birth fathers understand the incredible gift it is to say, for those things I can't provide, I will make arrangements. And every one of us who are parents in this room do that all the time. Don't we? I can't provide my child's medical care. She needs that. I make arrangements for that. I didn't homeschool my children. Should not be graduating from Baylor next year if I had. I made arrangements for that. I couldn't teach her piano. I made arrangements for that. Is that right? And when it came time for prom and makeup and stuff like that, I made arrangements for that. Because that's not the mom I am, right? Children's self-esteem is impacted by understanding placement, care arrangements, as a caring parental decision. You all are the social workers that can help parents understand that. Recommendations? You good?
I'm okay.
I'm all right.
I know, yeah, and I took medication. I would not be normal. All right. Stereotypes are really true. Adoption is not less than. It doesn't make me, as a birth mother, less than any other mother. Mm-hmm. Didn't make a decision selfishly, although perhaps I did in some way, and that's okay too. And I don't think you should discount that there are selfish motivations, and that's okay too. Value and validate adoption, certainly. And when Helen and I started this process of looking through and reading, she shared an article with me, and we were reading through all these different things, and we both commented on the fact that we were disturbed by how much more socially acceptable it is to have an abortion than it is to talk about and consider adoption, much less to use adoption as a viable family option. And that's something that we have to change. Recognizing that there's pain and loss all through but there is opportunity for hope and healing and validate those things as well. Open adoption is fantastic. After about 2 years, I couldn't go pick up the letters anymore. I couldn't do it. It was really like, it was worse than picking out a scab. It was like pouring salt on it, rubbing it in, and pretending I liked it. So I just decided that when death was ready to find me, then that opportunity would present itself, and that I would never, ever want to put myself in the position of disrupting her life either, and that if it was important to her to reconnect with me, then she would find a way to do that. And so she did. And after we reconnected, and Diane sent me all of those letters, and I sat down with them, and my husband sat with me, and they sat next to me and held my hand. And I read through all of those letters, and it was like peering through a window and watching Beth grow up. And I got to do it all in one night, which most parents don't get the opportunity to do. But it was unique and fantastic and beautiful, and it was sad. And I was sad because I had missed so many things, but I was also so grateful. She had been able to have piano lessons and enjoy horses and things like that. I would not have been able to do those things for her. And then reunion. Supporting reunion. Now, we know that we're a rare case. It should be this way for everybody. I wish it could be this way for everybody. But even if it's not as beautiful as our reunion is, just the opportunity to close that loop and find the place where you came from is an important part of every person's ability. One of the things that I gave to Beth just a couple of years ago for Christmas was a family tree from my family. And on the family tree, not only did we write the names of all the people, we also wrote stories about the people. Because these are things that we talk about in my family all the time. I'm sure you do too. You know, the weird uncle, or, you know, the crazy aunt who drives her Ford Fairlane at 100 miles an hour down the road, whatever it is. So we shared those stories with Beth too, so that she would have the opportunity to say, I know these things on this side of my family, and I know these things on this side of my family as well. So I think it's fun that Beth talks about her two moms, and we're saying, you know, it's interesting, we're two moms and we're not gay. And that's, you know, that's fun.
That's right.
We raise eyebrows. That's cool. And so now we're at the point where we would love to entertain your questions, and all of us are
happy to answer
questions. And don't be shy. You can ask anything you want. Yes, sir.
Beth, can you two show us the face you were talking about? You made it. You made it.
We call that ducklings.
I get that a lot.
We got a coffee maker out there too.
Yeah.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I have lots of questions, but I won't in a day. First of all, thank you. This needs to be out there in the big session where everybody can hear it. It's just so powerful and so beautiful, and we're all really just moved tremendously. One of my questions, and you guys said that we could ask anything, and I'm sure you've probably been asked this, but which of my questions may be for Katie? I'm wondering a little bit more about how you dealt with both the fact that you had a sister that your mom placed for adoption, and also the fact that your mom didn't place you, that you were the child that she raised, and even how just now you mentioned that that Beth had some things that you wouldn't have been able to provide for her. So was there any type of resentment, or did that question make sense?
There was never any resentment. She made the decision she made because she had reasons to do it. And whenever someone always asks me that question, I always get really protective of her. I'm kind of like, this is my mom. She made the decision because she wanted to. She loved both of us the same. but she made a better choice for Beth at the time in her life for certain reasons. So I don't have to... There were never any questions about if she loved me less or if she loved her more or if she loved her less. There was none of that. And she always showed that she loved me equally. And if not, you know, both of us the same.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I always wondered that too. I always asked Katie that question. Are you feeling okay about that? Because I never wanted her to wonder. And I always wondered if Beth wondered, you know, why me? Why did you pick me? And that's a difficult thing to struggle with. But from what I understand, we never asked that question. It's just not been one that's occurred.
I think all of you share so much hope, so much candid response and reaction. And even when you were talking about, Helen, when you were talking about both, and actually I think Beth used this word, this war, between being joyful for yourself and grieving for the birth family. And that, you know, the birth parent, that's something that, you know, I've contemplated myself. And even with the idea of an open adoption versus closed, the fact that sometimes, like if you have a child adopted from China where they're left at the orphanage and there is no access to any information, how do you reconcile that? Knowing that, you know, I mean, unless God intervenes, there's no way for them to connect with their birth parents. And so how do we reconcile some of that? So I just appreciate everything that you guys have shared today.
I will say to you that that's possible in the States as well. My father was the orphaned son of an orphaned son, raised in an unofficial adoptive home. And he was not able to find his birth mother. They hired detectives, tried several things, it just didn't happen. And I asked him when Beth searched and we found Jennifer, what the impact of that was on him. And he said, I'm scared for her. I'm scared for Beth because I don't want her to be unhappy or with what she finds. What if it's not good? Because he had speculated through the years. What if, you know, maybe it was better he didn't find his girlfriend. And then he began to weep and said, especially after Beth met Jennifer, Beth's heart is whole and that helps me. Yep. So we do what we can, you know, as much as we can. Were you going to say something?
Is this a woman's narrative?
Powerful question. You know, the literature says that only 5% of adoptive children express an interest in finding birth fathers. Somebody needs to look at what that question means. I wonder if, as father's role in families is changing from provider to active parent, you see many more stay-at-home dads. Dads who are much more involved in children's lives now than was true 15, 20, 25 years ago. I wonder if that will begin to change. I wonder if there'll be more searching interest, expression of interest in finding birth fathers. Does that answer your question at all?
Yes, and there is also a component of just some kind of, you know, we talk about DNA and faces and coffee. Isn't there some basic testosterone estrogen differential that makes this a woman's narrative and it will never be a man's narrative?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. I know that you have in the room an adoptive father and a birth stepfather who have a part of this narrative who I think would be quick to tell you how sort of central to their lives it is, but it's us who've written and are speaking. I don't know the answer to that.
Has this been a part of your journey that has worked for your birth father?
You know, I never had any real interest in searching for him. I knew very little about him. And we've talked about him. And the more that I find out about who he is, the more that I know that it was the right decision for me to not want to search for him.
Thank you. At least now. Maybe never.
See the social worker in me?
Yeah, being there. Yes, ma'am.
Well, I'm just thinking about the stigma surrounding adoption and your experience as a 19-year-old mother, and obviously your mother gave you that open door, but I'm sure, you know, I'm thinking, in my experience, we don't run across very many young girls giving up. You know, people say, oh, I'm pregnant, blah, 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 and you say congratulations. And so what was your experience with people around you, whether it be in social groups or your parents' friends or anything like that? Was there anything in particular they did to help support that, or did you, you know, what was that experience like?
Excellent question. When I was pregnant with Katie, I was 17, and I was the object of much shame and derision in my family. I was the black sheep. I was sort of that, you know, we don't talk about Jennifer and her condition. No, this is only 22 years ago, okay? But with a very, very southern family, and so it was a shameful thing. And at the same time, I'm a little bit headstrong. I don't know if that came across, but I was loud and proud about it. I'm pregnant. I'm 17 and I'm pregnant. I went to high school. I made a 4.0 GPA. I wasn't going to let anybody tell me that I was somehow less than or damaged or in any way not good enough. When I got pregnant with Beth, the first thing my mother said was, not again. Because I clearly, not too long before, been in that same situation. This was a different father from Katie's father. I'd only known this man for about 3 months. I was terrible all the way around. I was absolutely a statistic. Absolutely. And my mother didn't want to talk about it. She didn't want to talk about it to anybody. I didn't really have much in the way of friends because I was working 2 jobs and going to school. But my classmates in nursing school, they were very curious about what I was going to do and how I was going to do it, because we're all, you know, baby nurses, so we're all trying to figure out, that's kind of neat, how does that work? I'll tell you, the pediatric rotation during that time was one of the most difficult nursing rotations that I ever went through. And then when I went back later to complete my registered nursing degree, I couldn't get through the pediatric rotation because I was mad at every mother that had abused their child, because those are the kids that I took care of. They couldn't find the kid with cystic fibrosis for me to take care of. No, I was taking care of kids who were abused. I was mad. How dare you treat a child that way? Mm-hmm. Look what I've had to do. I mean, it was very selfish, but look what I've had to do, and this is how you are. I mean, there was a whole lot of that. It took me a long time to work through all of that. But my father and the rest of my family, my parents were divorced and had been for many years, my father and the rest of my family simply quit talking to me. I didn't speak to my dad for a long time, and that, you know, I was the oldest daughter and all that kind of weird dad stuff, you know, like, that was it. My aunt and uncle, or my dad's youngest brother and his wife, were having a difficult time conceiving, and they asked if I would, instead of giving the baby to strangers, if I would give her to them. And I said no. That's because I knew in my family it would become a secret, and that it would be something that nobody would talk about, and that if I went to the family reunion and they were there, that I would be ostracized, and I wouldn't, and Katie would not be treated the same way. There was no way that I was going to subject any of us to that kind of treatment. And my family was not happy about that, and even now they find it difficult on that side of my family to talk about and incorporate Beth into those conversations about family. And maybe sometimes I poke at them with them a little bit, because somewhere in me is still a 19-year-old girl who's a little bit hurt their family couldn't figure out that it was a good decision. Did that answer your question?
Yeah. And I'm like right up against the phone.
We want to thank you.
Thank you.
We want to encourage you to be advocates for adoption, to be advocates for valuing all persons, for not putting up with the stigma and the stereotypes, and speaking truth. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you for joining us today for NACSW's Podcast of the Month featured selection. We hope you found today's session useful and that it will support your efforts to thoughtfully integrate Christian faith and social work practice. We also hope that you will consider participating in additional NACSW's activities and events, including NACSW's upcoming convention in the fall, our quarterly audio conference workshops that we offer at no cost to NACSW members and which includes free CEUs accredited by the Association of Social Work Boards, our online continuing education program, and access to dozens of archived podcasts from the members section of our website. Also, we invite you to join NACSW's Facebook group or our Facebook fan page. For additional information about these and other NACSW benefits and services, you can go to our website at www.nacsw.org. Thanks again for listening in today to our podcast session today.